Hello, everyone. This is Greg, your host of Goddamn GameCube. Welcome to Season 3. If you enjoy listening to our show, consider subscribing to us on YouTube for exclusive video content. Thank you and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Goddamn GameCube. This is the Season 3 finale, Games and Culture. Can you guys believe we've done 75 of these? As we always do during the season finale, and we're going to continue to do, we always go through some goddamn GameCube business. We're going to talk about some business items first, and then we're going to get into the content of the episode. So I am going to hand it to Beppy, my co-host, first, who has the most important news. So please go ahead.
Jeez, I thought you were going to do it. Okay. So I've been dutifully sitting here and taking it the last couple weeks. I have actually begun the process of changing my name to Riley. I apologize if this makes anybody uncomfortable or is confusing. But basically, to sum up the reasoning, just try living with the name Beppy for your entire life. Just give it a shot. You will not have fun when you go to put your name down at Starbucks or a restaurant. No one's going to get it right. If you have to talk to racist old men on the phone, they're not going to know what it is. I never had any particular attachment to it. It was just the name I was given. Didn't really like the way it sounded. Just trying to make a fresh start here, have a nice kind of mature lease on life. I liked the name Riley. So from now on, we are going to hopefully do that. And I'm going to kick it back to you, Greg.
Yeah, thanks. So I just want to make sure everyone in the audience knows that we had talked several weeks ago about almost like, okay, we're going to go by Beppy on the show when we get to either the finale or the next season.
Yeah.
Then we're going to...
We almost had a couple slip-ups, but yeah, we made it.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so hard for me to call you Riley in real life. But then I calling you
Beppy.
You
did a good job.
I tried, I think. So anyway, Riley is now here with us.
New character.
This is not a new actor. We didn't change him out. This is the same one.
We did not change hosts.
This is the artist formerly known as Beppy is now Riley.
Hopefully in time it'll sound natural.
Anyway, here we go. So the first business item that I'm going to bring up is show growth. So we get some funny comments like in our direct messages. And in our Twitter messages, it's very complimentary, but fans always say to us, I just found you on social and I thought you guys would be bigger. Like they always say that. And it's like, I feel like that means like it either sounds good or they enjoy the show or we come off like we're much more popular than we are.
It's all in the mindset.
So what I want to say is number one, thank you. We do put a lot of effort into not only quality of the script, and the research, and also we do a full production pass on all of this stuff. What just to give you guys some insight into sort of how Goddamn GameCube has grown, I do want to make a note. Goddamn GameCube actually just had its second birthday.
That's right.
So we did turn two. And thank you to the fans who also put their Spotify Wrapped of how much they listen to Goddamn GameCube. That was fun. So for a little insight, during season one, we got about 200 plays in a week. Friends and family, random plays. In season two, we got about 400 plays in a week. And now in season three, across all of our platforms, we're getting about 2,000 plays a week. And that is about 1,000 of you listening every week. So for our pocket of 1,000 fans, thank you. We are going to try to continue to grow Goddamn GameCube. And you being a part of that community is extremely helpful. And it's also means a lot. It feels nice. It feels nice not to talk to nobody.
Into the void.
Into the void. Something I do want to mention is another business item. A lot of you are Spotify listeners. Spotify has just launched the ratings section of their app. So if you listen to us on the Spotify app, you can leave us a review and leave us a rating. That really helps our algorithms and having people find us.
I believe we've gotten enough ratings that it shows the star rating.
I believe it does.
Because you have to cross a certain threshold.
Yeah, I believe so.
And we've gotten enough in the short amount of time, and that's awesome.
So something I want to say, personally about a goddamn GameCube season 3. For me, I kept saying it kind of feels like a greatest hit season to me, where like we did what? There's some Halo, there's Metal Gear Solid, there's Silent Hill. We had a Don Rawich Oregon Trail, which was kind of crazy. Rooster Teeth was on the show. So thank you to them for, you know, us collaborating, and Nick for setting that up, Nick the intern. also another big thank you to Nick the intern, because our YouTube channel has expanded a lot as well. And that is entirely Nick's effort mm-hmm. into making sure our YouTube channel looks good. So we should also say this, Nick isn't actually the intern.
I consider Nick a partner.
Yeah. It's a fun little moniker that I gave myself. Yeah,
Nick gave himself the intern moniker on Twitter, and it just, it's still there.
I don't think of you as like, go get me coffee, Nick.
Yeah.
I would if you asked me.
Yeah. You did offer.
Yeah. But. So the last business item I'm going to bring up that is really funny. The last business item I am going to bring up, which is super important, we are going to be launching a goddamn GameCube Patreon and Discord. It is going to be coming sometime in the spring, so keep on the lookout on our social media. Feel free to follow us everywhere. We're going to be tweeting, as I call in the off season. That is going to be launching. You know, the goddamn GameCube community has grown by 1,000% in the past 2 years, so we love having you guys. And before we get into the content, I do want to say this break between season 3 and 4, we're estimating we're going to come back around April, right around PAX East time. I do want to say I will be singing at PAX East again in the Barbershop Quartet. So if you happen to be going to PAX East and you want to come say hi to goddamn GameCube, I will be there. My other cohorts, we're not sure yet in terms of Nick the intern and Riley, but we'll figure that out.
You might see Derek, one of our former guests,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, Derek's going to be singing with me as well. Go ahead, Nick. Did you have a business item?
Yeah, so I just wanted to comment on some of the things he said. It's been awesome to see the show grow, and it's been awesome to be a part of it. I really started becoming a partner / intern, starting like maybe mid-season 2 is really when I started to kick things off. And I wanted to mention, with the growth of our YouTube channel, while we will be on a bit of a break from doing official episodes, we will be launching some YouTube exclusive content. So we're going to try and do a few episodes between now and when we come back. So if you're not subscribed to our YouTube channel, please, please do. You may catch an exclusive episode of ours.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that.
You know, we are aware that we keep promising exclusive YouTube content, and we and like Nick says, we plan to beef that up. So that'll be something fun to look forward to. But no, this season in particular was, for me, maybe the hardest that we've put together so far. A lot of these Metal Gear games were exhaustive. I found myself physically exasperated after talking about them.
Yeah.
I hope it comes through in the production that you've enjoyed season 3. Just one of the reasons why we want to take a little break is that we can kind of get our feet back under us. I've seen a lot of people who do what we do, and they really kind of burn themselves out trying to get it together week to week. So our hope is that, you know, we, in doing so, we are kind of just creating a better season 4 for you guys. So thank you again for listening, and let's get into the episode.
Yeah. So this episode is games and culture. So Riley, why don't you actually start it? Because you kind of had like a 4-pillar structure of how we're going to go about doing this. So why don't you start it?
So why don't we start out with number one? I thought the most interesting. So basically my idea for this episode, once it sort of started to crystallize, was let's talk about how video games have influenced human culture across the board, all different aspects of life. Not only how have they grown internally in these in these subjects, but how they have kind of bled over into, you know, normal day-to-day life. So pillar number one, let's say, I said psychological / social. So right off the bat, I just wanted to kind of, there's so much pretty much for the history of video games, as long as they've been in the mainstream, there's been a lot of discussion about the mental health benefits / you know, downsides to video games, and a lot of research and studies about addiction. Do you guys have any opening thoughts about that?
I can comment a little on a benefit to mental health. Mm-hmm. I actually mentioned this. It's unfortunate that it's still relevant, but I mentioned this in the season two finale that during the pandemic, a lot of people found a lot of relief with playing Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
And I think games like that have a pretty profound, a positive effect on people's mental health, especially when you're dealing with so much solitude like we were and still are as the pandemic continues.
Yeah. I think, real world events, the world is a pretty scary place right now. And I think whereas in the past, video games were often derided for their escapism and sort of time wasting, I think a lot more people may kind of be getting it now. Like, okay, now I can kind of, there is unhealthy excesses in every kind of pastime. But if you're if you're using it as like a healthy kind of like, after work, let's dive into another world for a little while. Mm-hmm.
Can I actually tell you guys, I think I still have a little bit of a problem personally with that. Mm. I'm saying I struggle with that a little bit.
What do you mean?
By what I mean by that is I'm gaming when I'm in good spirits. Mm-hmm. I'm gaming when I feel like I'm being productive in my life. Mm-hmm. When I'm actually either like down or things that are maybe bothering me or things that I think I need to be moving forward in my life, I actually don't play games.
Yeah.
Games are almost like an extension of when I'm doing well. I tend to get through games fast. I want to consume stuff. I want to study it.
Yeah.
So that's really my take, where I feel like you're not going to find me gaming if I feel like I'm distracted, because games to me are not the distraction. Games to me are something that I really like to get my hands in.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say I'm the opposite of that, but it's an extension of when I'm doing well.
Like I want to like find the time for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
It's almost like a reward system. Hey, I've accomplished this thing, and now I can reward myself with a couple hours of this game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's how I do it.
Ties
sometimes
into what we're talking about, like having a good sort of work-life balance and, and finding times for all these different pastimes. I was going to say that, there has been so much talk about like all the negatives, like, and I think there is something to be said for it, but how violent tendencies, kind of negatively portraying like sex and all these different kind of criticisms that have been levied against it for, the last several decades. In terms of, I think, the positives, I did want to bring up how I feel like it's made my brain work faster in terms of problem solving and kind of that need to like 100% things like, have kind of that detail oriented mindset, at work where I kind of attack every little problem and solve it. And I do want to attribute that to the interactivity of video games. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been super helpful for me. There has been a lot of, research demonstrating, it's been great for memory, especially people who are getting older, kind of playing those brain games and stuff, retention. Simulation is a big part of where games have gone, and in terms of the way that your brain can be trained for real life experiences through not even if you're not necessarily going to call them games. We had a little bit of a discussion with Don, the Oregon Trail guy, about this, about how it can kind of better prepare you. I was going to mention, even if we're not saying strictly games, I think a gamey kind of influence has taken over a lot of apps like Duolingo, like teaching you stuff like that. It's made it, and kind of exercise games as well. And in a sense where you would maybe kind of be like dragging your ass to get to the gym. Like you see a lot of, when Wii Fit came out, it makes you get that itch and you want to scratch that itch. And I think that's a good example of what games can be used for.
Yeah.
Team building as well. A lot of that, I think it's definitely just one of those things where it's like how you use it. It can be used for good or ill.
Yeah. If we're going to talk, you said the word team building, I'd like to branch a little bit into social.
Yeah, if you don't mind,
because this might sound, I'm going to use the word anachronism a lot today when we're recording.
Interesting.
Good word. Yeah. So I was thinking of this when we were preparing for this episode. Do you know what I thought of? Because now we are all either 30 or approaching 30. I am 29. Nick, you're having a birthday soon. So what I was thinking about the other day, can you guys think about, I want you to think about how you experienced games as a community when you were 8 or 9 years old versus now. Do you know what I was thinking about the other day? Do you remember when Pokemon came out in the 90s and the only way you'd find out how to catch rare Pokemon is either you talk to your friends on the bus in the morning or someone had the guide?
Yeah.
Like there was, what I was thinking about the other day was, what do I do now when I finish a game? I Google, this is funny. I thought Deathloop sucked, Reddit. I literally Google name of game Reddit to see what people think about it, or maybe, or like, if I didn't understand the story, did other people know that, or did other people interpret the story differently than me? But back when I was very young, I could only talk about games or share my experiences with games like in real life with people face to face.
Yeah.
And now it is way different.
I was gonna tie that into sort of like, for me, I don't know about you guys, but for me, there was a lot of like social stigma involved with that, which I think persists to this day, maybe a little less, but it became less hostile when I linked up with people online and kind of got out in the world a little bit and realized that maybe I wasn't so uncommon.
You know, I can agree with that. Way back when, I would say when I first, you know, I'm over 30 now, but when I first started like getting professional jobs, like, you know, I'm 23, 24, I never told a soul at the office that I played video games.
Yeah.
Cause I was like, they're going to look down on me. They're going to think I'm unproductive.
It's not like the first thing I lead with, you know?
Yeah. It's not the first thing I lead with either. But now I think these days it's more accepting. Like I had a full on talk about video games with a couple of coworkers. Like,
I'm gonna blow your minds
ago.
A little. I'm gonna this is an extension of what you're talking about.
Ooh, go ahead.
Video games have changed so much in culture for me. It is the first thing job interviews ask me about.
Interesting.
Is goddamn GameCube.
Really?
It's happened to me twice now.
That's cool.
Where, I mean, obviously I can't say the names of the companies. I had two music companies ask me, I you know, I'm looking at your whatever, they're looking at my experience, whether it's in live music or production or, you know, in marketing efforts. But they said specifically, I want to know what the podcast is,
cool.
Which is very weird to me.
Yeah.
Because I think what's happening is not only has podcast culture become a giant marketing word, I think games are now being accepted as a people older than us are now understanding, mom and dad, that video games are the biggest entertainment industry in the world by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're not going to get into like tech and economy yet in the pillars. But for me personally, video games are almost the first thing I talk about with people now because it's become a, if you friend me or what, don't do this, but if you friend me on social, your goddamn GameCube is the first or second thing that people see.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think it's become very accepted. Like when we posted that we got the Oregon Trail guy on the show, all of my friends from out of the woodwork were like, dude, we all played that in elementary school.
Well,
how did
I was going
to
say that like a lot, you know, it's so many series and characters are so iconic that it becomes sort of a cultural touchstone where it's like,
sure,
oh, well, you can talk to someone like halfway around the world, they'll know what fucking Super Mario Brothers is. You know what I mean? Like it's so kind of woven into the DNA of socialization. And I think it's so funny that you brought that up because I was going to say that it's interesting because we use so much profanity on this show that you would use it in a professional context. But I think I think what another lesson to learn from that is that a lot of places are hiring a lot more flexibly now where, you know, you don't necessarily have to have all these specific qualifications. They're a little more open-minded.
I have a funny anecdote about that. Yeah. One of the job interviews that I was doing, they asked me about my podcast and I literally said to them, my podcast has a curse word in it. Can I say it in the interview?
Yeah.
And they said, yes. So then I do, that is the funny curse about being called this. Our podcast name is very funny,
right?
But like, I have to be careful who we're talking to. Like, do you remember, we won't go too far off topic here. We were getting the Rooster Teeth collaboration together and someone's mom said, this podcast has a rude name in it. Do you know them? Or something like that.
That's right.
Or
that's
something
right.
To that,
yeah.
to that effect. Right. That's really funny too.
Yeah. So I guess before we get off this topic, I did want to not kind of shy away too much from the negative stuff.
Yeah, sure.
So I think this is a lot of it is very kind of stuff that if you had a degree of foresight, you could have seen a lot of this coming. Just kind of the negatives of human behavior sort of starting to seep through. You know, now you have a lot more kind of community, you know, like we just had an episode on Journey where we talked about the limitations that were instituted to prevent, you know, trolling and griefing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you kind of, everyone makes a joke about, you know, like Halo or Call of Duty lobbies where back in the day you heard fucking everything.
Oh, my God. Just,
Gears of War lobby that you used to get.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And I think,
what up?
I think if you grew up back then, you developed like a thick shell, but now it would be pretty shocking to hear some of the stuff that was thrown around.
Yeah.
There was a lot of harassment, God forbid you were a girl.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that still happens today, too.
Still happens. Yeah. I don't want to say that this is in the past, but it is unfortunate just because of the anonymity.
Yeah.
People think they can get away with this shit. And, mm-hmm. So that is something I just wanted. I mean, it did kind of, it is sort of brought up in terms of where that this doesn't really happen in other, you know, like if you're going to the movies, you're kind of like paying attention to yourself and that's it. You
know what I mean?
So I do want to, you know, if there's a little bit more engagement, interaction, cooperation, competition, you're getting all the pros and cons of that.
That's a great point. I never really thought about that, that the other media or mediums don't really have that sort of thing that video games do.
It's just sort of bringing out, like, because it's such the internet in general, too. Like, it's such a Wild West thing at first where it was like, wow, we can say whatever we want, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, over time, this has been improving, you know, as we sort of we give people the opportunity to straighten up and fly right. And if they don't, they get banned from wherever.
Right.
Phil Spencer has been cracking down recently. And if you saw that,
I don't know.
Xbox is not a free speech platform. We're going to ban you for life.
Jesus,
all this interesting stuff. So that's a whole nother ball of wax.
To make a really funny show. But, clearly, Xbox is not a free speech platform. If I was physically grabbed by Major Nelson, tell me to shut up about Morrowind.
Don't talk about Morrowind, or you're gonna get
your ass kicked.
Oh my god, collared.
Oh my god. But
did you guys have anything else to add about this?
I did. Yeah.
I'll go after you.
I actually do. It's so interesting. Like, maybe not how I'm gonna be very. I'm trying to be very careful with what I'm about to say. I do have some concerns about video games. Mm-hmm. I have many concerns, not only with design, but we're talking about social.
Yeah.
10 years ago, or maybe when I was in high school, I scoffed at the idea that violent video games like affect kids or like they're going to bring that violence into school or somewhere else. Do you guys feel like as you get older, you think about that more, or do you still kind of snuff your nose at that? Because what I think about is, you know, there's a lot of violence all over the world. There's a lot of violence in the United States. There's a lot of, maybe I'm getting old. I worry a little bit about all of these. I can't believe I'm talking like this. Mm-hmm. All of these like Call of Duty war simulator stuff that really desensitizes you to conflict.
Yeah.
And that is the most popular game in the world for kids that are so young. I was young playing Call of Duty and, you know, at 10, 11, 12, 13.
Well,
do you guys know what I'm saying?
I do. And so I have a couple comments to add to that where this is unlike what I just was talking about. This is not unique to games where it's kind of, you know, I've been getting into the Scream movies. There's a new one of those. And there was a series of, you know, killings where they're like, oh, we're just like the killer in that movie, you know? And, it happens all the time, you know, Matrix, like everything, like it's blamed on the big movie at the time. And then we have this big conversation about how the movie is corrupting our youth. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of becomes a, can we trust this type of media to be out there wherein parents maybe are not drawing the line between fiction and reality enough? I suspect as we get older, and if anybody has kids in this group, we're going to be a lot more concerned about that kind of thing.
Sure.
I do agree with you. And this is actually something that we may have touched briefly on in the MGS4 episode where they were talking about. Do you remember this part where Big Mama is talking about how kids are raised on FPS games and how they're like, you know, kind of ready mates, and you know how often they have like ads for the army and like some of these COD games, I think.
Do you know what it is? It's just, I'm trying to be very cautious because I don't know like which side of the table I'm gonna fall on here. Yeah. All I'm saying to our fans is I have thought about it more over the past 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
As all of these like horrible kind of like mass shootings.
Yeah, and by thought about it more, I think more about a lot of violence in America. Video games are huge. A lot of media. People are consuming a ton of media and what it does.
Yeah.
I have thought about it more, at least.
I think for me, your point that you said about people becoming desensitized to violence, that's where I get concerned.
Yeah, sure.
Where, you know, I'm not going to put any correlation on media for anything that happens. You know, people could be influenced by so many different things. Because of video games, because of everything, people become so desensitized to killing and to violence. Like, they see one of these horrible events that happens, what feels like a weekly occurrence here, and they feel nothing.
Yeah.
And to me, that's concerning to me.
Yeah. I think it's for me, like, I mean, in terms of my own experience, I can't say, you know, I wasn't being exposed to super violent things when I was young. But, you know, if I see, like, someone getting chainsawed apart in Gears of War, I'm just like, oh, geez. But if I see something in real life, I have a very different reaction to it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think maybe I'm not speaking for us in the room. When Nick, like you and I, when you and I were kids, like we had a very clear delineation between real life and game.
Yes.
I remember getting Gears of War for our first, for when I was 14 for Christmas, we were chainsawing people and laughing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it is like, I mean, we can tell it's a game.
Yeah.
But something else you should maybe consider is that as games get more and more realistic and with VR and everything, maybe the line will start to blur a lot more.
Yeah.
It's true.
So it's just worth mentioning. I think there could be a lot better sort of representation of certain aspects of violence and their consequences, and you know, that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah.
But in terms of how they've evolved over time, I thought it was worth covering every angle there.
Yeah. Of course.
So I have one last point to bring up about social. So this is something that's always kind of bugged me, and I think it's getting better. It's not quite there yet, where people can we're. People think that playing a whole lot of video games is bad, but doing a whole lot of other media is fine.
Oh.
So, like, why? Okay.
Yeah, I'm so mad. Go ahead.
Someone can binge watch Squid Game all in one night, and that's considered awesome. Dude, that's so cool. But when I binge play Fire Emblem 7 in one sitting, I'm weird. Yeah. Come on.
I think that's now the teaser for this. No, I agree 100%. So our parents are in their 60s.
Yep.
And what I think is really funny is like my mom will binge the fuck out of shows.
Yep.
And I like if she like walks in and I'm playing a game, this is so funny.
Oh no.
Like I was literally playing Deathloop the other day. Spoiler, I didn't love it. So and my mom was so funny. She could tell I didn't really like it. And she comes in and she's like, I'm enjoying this really good show. I can see this game didn't quite loop de loop for you. I'm like, all right, fuck that. Awesome.
Go, mom.
That's really funny.
I can hear it in her voice.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So funny.
All right.
That's fantastic.
No, that is interesting though, because, and I feel like what people would say is that, I guess there's a thematic undertone to Squid Game. Whereas I don't know if there was one in Deathloop, but
if there was, I didn't find it.
I think there's. We're gonna get into this more later, but there's a lot of apples and oranges in this in these comparisons.
Right.
So let's move on to pillar two, which is economic.
Ooh,
all right.
Okay.
Like
so, it. So right off the bat, I just want to get all the you know obvious stuff off the way. This is obviously a whole nother industry where you have all this job creation, generate a huge amount of tax revenue. Sales about I think a figure I pulled from 2020 was that video games contributed $90 billion to the U.S. economy.
Jesus Christ.
So it's a hefty number there.
Thank you, Fortnite.
It's all Fortnite.
It's like, shut up.
Esports is it's all whole ball of wax. I mean, I think another number that I pulled out was that 90% of their revenue is from advertising or sponsorships.
Wow.
So people are starting to And by people, I mean very greedy, cynical corporations are starting to see the dollar signs when it comes to video games and seeing how popular they are. And I think that has been something we'll get into later, is that a kind of a handicap to people seeing them as art is how commercialized they already are. And so I did want to get into this in terms of all these...
it makes me so mad.
Greg's already shaking his head.
Can I tell you, you didn't make me mad. Everything you just put together in your brain makes me so angry.
Listen, but I'm right, right?
Can I tell you why? I'm going to make this comparison. I just feel like let's go in my brainstem for a second.
Yikes.
What you just said was so funny to me because it's so correct. So when we were kids, we're wrong for playing video games because they're lame and nerdy and stupid. Yep. And now we're wrong for playing video games because they're not art. They weren't art then and they're not art now, just for different reasons. That makes me so mad.
Yeah. So we can't win. We're shutting down the podcast. Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
No. So a couple other figures I wanted to bring up.
Yes.
This was also 2020, I believe. 64% of adults and 70% of under 18s play video games in some form. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like, it's very vague where it could even mean like phone games or something. Sure. Or whatever. But interesting nonetheless that, you know, a significant number of the population.
I will say a significant number of the population admitted to playing games. That's a big number.
That's a big step.
You know
actually.
What I mean? It's not just like maybe someone who plays games on their phone won't say anything.
Right.
Yeah. You know? Average age, I believe, from this study was 35 to 44. So it's
okay. Developers who are older than us.
A pretty wide spectrum, though, because I'm assuming that's kind of creating like the mean between very young people, probably a lot of them, some older people as well.
Yeah.
So basically, what did I say? More than 214 million Americans play video games at some point during that year.
Wow.
Huge amount, roughly 2/3-ish.
Yeah.
And I think a big part of that is how much more affordable they are now, comparatively. So it's going to sound ridiculous because I think the current gen ones are like $70, right?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about like at the time, adjusted for inflation, like the big one is like Commodore 64 was like, it would have been now $800.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Versus, you know, whatever PS5 is.
I've made this comparison before, where you said video games are comparatively inexpensive compared to other entertainment. Way yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Or think about, I mean, okay, we're in the biggest sports market in the US, right? Mm-hmm. In New England. What does it cost to get a ticket to the Patriots? $200?
Pretty much.
That's before resellers.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like, and if you think, even if you spend max price on a game of $70, and also are you going to that game alone? Probably not. It's a huge amount of money to do other things
for parking,
that are not video games.
Yeah.
So comparatively, it almost makes me feel bad about complaining how expensive video games are.
Well, yeah, but I meant more like in terms of time, whereas it used to be a lot more expensive as a hobby. Yeah. And you know, I think that was sort of the influx of the big crash was how they couldn't sell it to anybody because nobody could afford it.
Yeah.
So then you have this big reinvention where there's a lot more emphasis on home consoles, and that's how we are where we are.
Mm-hmm. You know, you make a great point too. You both did actually by comparing, you know, how relatively cheap they are and how relatively cheap they are compared to other forms of entertainment. Mm-hmm. The only other things I can really think of that are similar to a video game in value is maybe a book. Or if you buy a movie, because even if you go to a movie with a video game, the main selling point is, you might have to drop $70 on a game and that seems expensive, but
on
you
a
own
new
it.
Game.
Right. On a new game. Yes. Yeah. But you own it and you can then play it whenever you want. It doesn't expire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hopefully those downloaded games don't expire at any point, but you know, as of right now, they don't expire.
Our fears are well documented. Right?
Yeah.
But like you go to a sporting event that costs you a couple $100. You can't use that ticket again. It's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
A movie ticket is a lot cheaper than a video game, mostly, but it's also gone when you use it.
Yeah.
That's why I kind of compare a video game to a book. You kind of have it forever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty cool that you guys brought up that point. I didn't really think about it like that.
That's a good way to describe it. I guess broadening out here in terms of the structure that started to emerge, I feel like I mentioned a little bit, it's kind of a Wild West thing where at first... it was odd because we grew up kind of in a time where games were much less defined in terms of, you know, the market and trends and everything like that. And we sort of grew up with it and watched it, you know, sort of solidify. And so we've talked at great length about a lot of the exploitation. You know, we had our big Games and Pieces episode.
Yes.
Yeah. Very big. This is kind of going to tie it all in together, yeah. I think, this episode. Mm-hmm. But I did want to mention, I think since that episode, the very first union has been formed. It's very small, and I'm not sure how accomplished or anything, or how you know useful it will be, but it's a step. And it happened in December, and it was Vodio Workers United, I believe it's called.
I haven't heard of this.
Yeah, that's a game developers union.
Yes.
Okay.
So
okay.
They're you know committed to representing you know everybody throughout America, and just kind of I think it's a nice first step after all this talk. There's been a lot of smoke. So that's one thing about it that I mean, because I don't really want to retread old ground, but it's mm-hmm. it's been a pretty hot topic on this podcast for a while. Mm-hmm. Is how kind of I would say maybe just because of what I know about game developer work life balance, mm-hmm. It seems like really aggressive, and it seems like a lot of people are being very heavily exploited, even compared to kind of the average American worker.
I mean, mm-hmm. you're right. We did do an episode on the fall of Telltale Games where that was a very big and prominent issue with that company.
Huge. Mm-hmm.
So, and now that, you know, unions are forming, like, I think it's all a good thing that this is happening now.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Just kind of, and it's fascinating because you think about that we, you know, thinking back to Don Rawich, how, you know, thinking of the very simple kind of his little learning project back in the 70s.
How did we get from tabletop to
and
here?
How long mm-hmm. did it take us to, you know, kind of
literally 50 years
workers rights. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Like quite literally 50 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it was 1971. It's 2022. Yeah.
We got the whole span here. Mm-hmm. And so basically I didn't want to, this is kind of a lot of homework, this part, but I didn't want to, leave us hanging here without some positive news here.
Of course.
I thought it might be a good opportunity for Greg to talk about the charities that video games are capable
of. Yeah. How thoughtful of you. That's very good. so some of you probably saw it on social media. Some of you donated. So thanks. So video games also, have a lot of, philanthropic efforts around the world.
Good word.
Thank you. I participate in Extra Life. I actually met Extra Life at PAX.
Oh, cool.
And Extra Life is a Miracle Network Children's Hospital charity. There are Miracle Network hospitals all around the United States. Boston Children's happens to be our local. And it's one of these almost like running for cancer or sponsoring someone for cancer running sort of mm-hmm. charities where, you know, someone will, sponsor me $50 to beat Resident Evil as fast as possible.
Right.
And, you know, and for 24 hours, I'm going to game and I'm going to donate all that money to charity to my local hospital. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of charities like this in games. I think they're like criminally like under, I wonder if the right word is, not popular.
Underutilized.
Yeah. Like Extra Life, you're giving 100% of your funds. This is not an advertisement, but it is a, I guess it is. You're giving 100% of your donation to the Miracle Network hospital of your choice. And like, I hate to say almost no one does it. Comparatively to people who run for cancer, no one does this.
I don't know why people don't. Like in video games, you don't even have to run. It's pretty great.
I can't believe I finally have a platform to say this. That was very funny, by the way.
thanks.
There are so many athletes who play games like Fortnite and shit. I can't believe like they are not collaborating with children's hospitals.
Feels like a big opportunity
life.
That yeah. is so not
if you are an
seized.
Athlete and you happen to listen to this, collaborate with your local children's hospital and Extra Life. Why not?
A lot of athletes tend to do events or
charitable work
for children's hospitals anyway. So it seems like it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, the person in the gaming community that we follow, Alana Pierce, does a ton of charity work every year.
Yeah.
They're all gaming related. I believe Able Gamers is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
She does a ton of that stuff. So yeah. There is a lot of very positive charitable work in games.
I was going to bring up the most famous recent ones with like Hasan Piker was a big
yes.
one.
Yeah, okay.
And the one with H-Bomber Guy where he did the Donkey Kong 64 thing.
Yep.
And AOC popped on and Chelsea Manning and all that.
Yeah.
A big thing. So it's kind of, you know, you're gradually, slowly but surely, it's kind of a burgeoning opportunity there. And what's the other big one? Child's Play is the other big one.
I think so.
And I forget a couple other ones, forgive me. But I just wanted to, because I feel like this is probably the one pillar that I have the most complicated feelings about, so mm-hmm. I didn't want to leave it, you know, without saying something nice. That,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
I think another nice thing you could say, you did mention this toward the beginning of the pillar that is generating so much for the economy, so much revenue, but it also generates so many jobs.
Yes.
For like writers, for yeah. artists.
Are you running
designers.
For office? I'm kidding.
this generates jobs. We need more video games.
Yeah.
More sewer levels.
Yeah.
No more swamp levels.
The American people are sick and tired of sewer levels.
So, okay.
Go on.
Now, I had an opportunity to say that to Bernie. I didn't. But anyway, I actually wrote that down, Nick. So I know Nick is still cackling. Okay. I actually wrote that down as well, that like there has, I think about the amount of job creation we wouldn't have mm-hmm. without games. Also, people who do a lot of different things now work on games. You can be an artist, graphic designer, programmer, coder. Mm-hmm. You can be a producer, musician. Holy shit.
Forget right? about, you know, all the marketing and everything.
Marketing.
That's a whole other
It's a lot. I mean, okay. We're kind of full stop here. It's the biggest entertainment industry in the world. So
right.
obviously it has created a lot of jobs.
It's really great for the economy in that way.
Sure.
Okay. So let's move on
pillar
to
three.
Technological. Let's get into this a little
bit. Beep, bop, boop.
So most of this, I was going to kind of talk a little bit about how the technology itself has evolved over time. You know, we keep going back to Don, and but I mm-hmm. mean, I want to reiterate how I was really taken aback during that interview when he was painting the picture of, you know, this was a text-based game at first, and there was no, you know, graphics to be had, nothing to look at. You had to use your imagination for everything, and it was fascinating. And so in that vein, I wanted to talk about how, think a little bit more clearly about how arcade cabinets were kind of the norm, and mm-hmm. you had to go out to play games, mm-hmm. and now you have a lot more home consoles, PCs, a lot more affordable. Pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of before in the mid 90s, before you had, you know, reliable internet, you had a lot more LANing, you know, just kind of like, I guess, people dicking around playing Doom in their office.
I mean, I went to a handful of Halo LAN parties back in the day.
Handful.
Right. Eighth grade, middle school.
Yep.
You get that system link.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, and then versus, you know, I think Ethernet cards became a lot more.
Sure.
You know, mainstream. I wanted to mention that the first online console was the Dreamcast.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
You know, I heard about that. I don't know what game was
I could
online,
be wrong. I believe it was Phantasy Star.
That would make a lot of
sense. I think it's Phantasy Star.
And,
okay.
And it's kind of seen as like its downfall because it was ahead of its time.
I mean, it's the same thing as the place. I mean, I don't know if you guys know this. The GameCube and the PS2 had an internet out. How did you play the Resident Evil co-op games online? You had to use the 56K connection out of the PlayStation 2.
Right.
You could also play, I believe it was Phantasy Star Online on your GameCube. So, I mean, dude, like when if you have a pillar called technology, we could talk about almost anything, right?
We could go all day. I mean, and I wanted to tie in also, we had a RuneScape episode.
Fuck yeah, we did.
Was this the first MMO?
Oh, man. I mean, maybe the original could have been one of the first.
I mean, to say 2001? This, as much as I know, RuneScape was one of the... Keep in mind, this is very related to what you're talking about. RuneScape was a text-based game.
Yes.
It was a text-based MUD.
MUD,
and
yes.
It became a graphic MUD, and then I think that's how the term ended up being created for what kind of game it is. I don't know. No, that's got to be EverQuest. Or something like that. It's got to be the first MMO.
But RuneScape's got to be damn
close. It's
got to
be tough. It's definitely up there.
Popularized it, at least.
At least.
Sure.
And
it's the first one I ever heard of.
Nick, I can't believe we didn't talk about this.
Uh-oh.
Social and RuneScape for us?
Oh,
Jesus Christ.
Holy shit, I didn't even think about that.
Because if you think about MMOs, we just don't play them anymore.
We don't
but back then, it was a huge social aspect for us.
I can probably... thank my typing and ability to type quickly skills on RuneScape, to be honest.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And you know, when we're still talking hardware here, thinking about what a big deal it was for me, you know, my Game Boy Pocket was my first console.
Hell yeah.
You know,
I believe, us too, right?
I think we all were Game Boy
Original Pocket. Game Boys or something.
Yeah. And, you know, just kind of watching. It's so funny to see how, you know, I remember when I got the first DS and that can play like N64 level graphics. And I was just like, oh, cool. So it's like slowly catching up. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, now you have like your phone, which can play like anything.
Yeah, or like, that's, or like you crazy. Now have a homogenous product, the Nintendo Switch, which eliminated the 3DS.
Which is a very interesting move.
Which
by
now you can now play a handheld game on your television and vice versa.
It's, I still think that's same. Pretty freaking cool.
And there's you know, it's almost, not every game is the same quality, but you get close,
yeah,
which is very impressive.
Kind of interesting the way it sort of coalesced there. I wanted to get into graphs a little bit.
Evolution
of that. Graphs,
yep.
You know, 8 versus 16 versus 32 versus 64, you know, like let's talk about some preferences here. What do we think?
You're talking now, if we're talking graphics and preferences, Nick, you know what I'm gonna say.
Absolutely.
I fucking love sprites.
Sprites are awesome.
Love timeless sprites. I love Game Boy Advance sprites. What I think is really interesting, we were too young at the time. But what I think is fascinating to me that the Nintendo 64, it's the name of it, how good the graphics were in the name.
Yeah.
It's 64-bit.
It's just very catchy. Yeah.
And what I think is interesting is it is literally double as nice looking as the PS1. Still didn't have the sales numbers.
Right.
Isn't that crazy? Also, the N64 was also incredibly hard to develop for other reasons that are, you know, we could go on forever.
It's funny though, because it's like, you know, thinking back to when Nintendo was like the graphics titan.
Isn't it so strange how GameCube was the graphics king? Yeah. Does it make you feel weird?
A little.
Yeah, it does make me feel strange.
But no, I just watching that, it feels like so... If almost no difference at all now between console generations. Like,
yeah,
it's like,
I mean,
so slight.
That's like a very important thing to bring up.
Diminishing returns.
Diminishing returns on console generations. For me, the biggest jump for me personally was going from like your PS2 to our Xbox 360.
Yeah.
That was probably when I went, whoa, games look really good now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe when I was a kid, I didn't care so much.
As an adult, I still don't care that much.
That's true. But when you started going from like late Xbox 360 and Xbox One, you get into this new generation, the gap gets smaller and smaller and smaller. I've started saying this in the past couple of years where it's 2022. Every game looks good. And if it doesn't, then I notice.
Right.
That's a good point.
Every game looks good. Right. I'm now more impressed by, we're going to get to this pillar, I'm more impressed by art style.
Yeah.
Because the standards for game fidelity are crazy now. They're huge.
And I kind of wanted to dovetail off of that into sound well, and how that has improved over time. And not only that, but, you know, we just had our big MGS episode, and I was going to say that not only you know, is it getting more and more realistic, we can have like great more soundscapes, dynamic sounds. We had our Hellblade episode last season where we talked a lot about this.
Binaural audio,
exactly.
Yeah,
but like, you know, MGS with getting not only being able to have fully voice acted stuff, but there's kind of, that's a whole new way to judge a game, is does it have good music and voice acting.
Yeah, I mean, something I can't believe I have a platform for this now too. I will say this, the technology of music in games has gone through the roof. I would argue that music has not gotten better. The actual tunes have not gotten better, but the technology that audio can now serve in a game is now awesome.
Right.
We're like, I mean, we don't really talk a lot of Call of Duty or Battlefield on this show, but one of the most impressive things to me was playing like Bad Company 2 or Battlefield 3 when I'm miles away and I'm shooting a sniper bullet and you just hear the breeze go by. That to me is insane.
And like, not only that, but that game in particular, I think with like all the particle effects and like, you know, the levels breaking apart and every little piece and everything.
I think
it's incredible.
Audio design is so important to a game. Like, I can't believe I even have to say that to some of you out there. where you know, if I now, like, I never mute a game ever. I can't. I need the whole experience. Mm-hmm. I want to. It's so funny too. like I think Link's footsteps in Ocarina of Time are still iconic to me, the little rhythm of the steps.
Yeah. I mean, especially in the Temple of Time, it's like ingrained in your mind. It's the echo of his steps going through the Temple of Time.
Everything matters. Stays with you. And you may not necessarily pick up on it the first time, but if you start paying attention, you see how the whole kind of symphony comes
and
together.
And it's what's really cool too. We could do a whole episode on this, is when you go from your program sounds to your complete symphonies.
Yes.
Like we talked a lot of Austin Wintory on the previous episode. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to the best studios and recording spaces in the world for a video game.
Yeah.
We've gotten that far. Where, I mean, it's a whole nother discussion about, is the music better? But the technology is now through the roof, and there's so much you can do.
Yeah, for example, like, for some older games, like maybe some ones that were on Game Boy Advance or something like that, you had the, I'm not sure what the technical term is,
the MIDI soundtracks
that maybe later on you would get an orchestrated version because they recorded it. Now, if you have a modern day game, the whole thing's orchestrated anyway because you don't need to have a MIDI version first.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that you don't need to have the two.
Interesting to me how, and I think in Dragon Quest you can choose.
Yes.
Or like, do you want the soft synth version or do you want the orchestrated
Neither
version?
Neither of them are any good, but I think the MIDI's better.
Yeah. But it's come in an unbelievable way. Like, it, you know, an audio team, this is a really good example too. We talked a lot about Silent Hill 2's music. Mm-hmm. That was all made by, what, one person?
Mm-hmm.
And now he's doing everything. Mm-hmm. And now you have composition teams.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if you're talking about like a modern game, you not only have the composer, you have the person who's doing the dictation, someone who's doing the score, you have your audio engineers, your mixing engineers. It is an entire production to do this stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Before we get off this, I wanted to delve into VR a little bit.
Oh, boy.
And how all this stuff is kind of, I mean, people have been talking about it at least since the 90s, probably earlier, just in terms of the sheer concept and how all these advances that are being made. And I wanted to get the negatives off my chest first.
Sure.
So you're seeing a lot of this kind of being applied to day-to-day life. You're seeing all this metaverse shit. It's like, it makes my skin want to crawl.
So, yeah.
And the putting the VR headsets on cows to make them look like think they're in a nice, beautiful field when they're not.
Don't like that at all.
It makes me want to throw up. Yeah, it's like it's set. So fucking awful. So I just wanted to be like, oh, well, games have brought us here too. You know, it's not all wonderful.
Things that I used to laugh at that are now getting more standard virtual reality.
It's more Kojima nightmare stuff.
Wait, I need to make sure for the sake of the audio listeners, I'm not saying cows with headsets is funny. Like what I'm saying is that was never, abusing animals was never funny. What I'm saying,
we know your history with animals.
Oh my God. What I'm saying is, I used to be like, virtual reality, whatever. They're just shitty video games.
Now
it's like, oh fuck, it's becoming the standard.
I mean, they even have those commercials now. Have you seen those where they're like, oh no, VR isn't just for gamer nerds. Oh, it's for working out. Have you guys seen those? Yeah, I don't remember what game it's for, but
like the Pelotons and stuff. Yes, I guess that's something I didn't even think of. But the Matrix is real now.
Yep, pretty much.
So we got that. And I did want to mention one cool thing about the tech that I haven't seen a lot of people talked about. Like, do you guys know about how The Mandalorian is made?
No.
Where it basically, they don't shoot on location at all. It's this huge, huge, like, cylinder that they put, like, a little, like, set in the middle, and then everything around them is a game engine. So basically, so the actors aren't just looking at a green screen. Like, the environment is moving to their, you know, kind of in a believable way.
Uh-huh.
So they know, like, what they're looking at.
That's super
kind
cool.
of interesting. And I feel like it's, you know, you can argue that, like, it doesn't look great sometimes, but I mean, I feel like it can only get better.
Yeah,
and you know, you think about like adding weather and you know, all this different stuff, and trying to maybe like cut down on how much, you know, production costs some of this stuff has, like the oil that you're using, like traveling from location to location.
Yeah.
I would say that is a big positive for me when it comes to tech.
Sounds, I agree,
really cool.
Can I bring up one point about tech that I need to get off my chest? It's kind of negative in a way, but it makes me sad.
Sad,
not super negative, but it's sad.
Uh-huh.
Tech has gotten so good, it almost makes couch co-op obsolete.
I know.
Which makes, we played a lot of couch co-op games, we still do, but it kind of hurts my soul when you see a game that should have couch co-op doesn't.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I love Divinity Original Sin. Yeah. I mean, yes, that's it. There you go. Yeah. Like the one example I have is Divinity Original Sin 2. When it came to the Switch, it does not have couch co-op.
I know. You see some things get phased out.
And I think that's very sad. Couch co-op, for us, it was huge when we were growing up. But I feel like even for parents and kids nowadays, it would be huge too.
You want it, but you can see why they maybe wouldn't justify spending the resources on including it.
That's why I say it's more so sad than negative, because I can see why they're not doing it, and it just kind of hurts me a little bit.
Yep. Yeah. No, I understand.
Anything else to add before we move on?
No.
Okay, we're going to get into the final round here, which is artistic.
I'd like to start with a quote.
Okay.
Oh, no.
So, did you say, oh, no? Yeah. So, I kind of chuckled to myself when I wrote this, where I was, like I said, I was preparing for this episode, and when it comes to artistic aspects of games, a big point I want to make is that... video game art has become so prevalent in either my life or the life of the world. I know more about video game art styles than I know about real ones. Example, like I could tell you all about 16-bit versus gothic style, but if you started talking to me about impressionism or realism, I don't know what those words mean. Like, you guys thought about that?
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, I have thought about how I...
how uncultured I am?
No, I'm maybe talking about like... When we watch a movie where it's like we're watching like a Matrix movie and like, oh, tough boss, or if an artist puts out an album that's really similar to the last one, I'm like, this is just some DLC. You know what I mean? So you start speaking in those terms, and I think it's kind of fun still. Like I haven't worn myself out on it yet.
Do you know, before we get into the main crux of the topic, I think what's so interesting too is now some movies are being compared to video games, not just the other way around. 1917, where it's shot from like over the shoulder the movie, and some reviewers were like, it's like the best looking Call of Duty that they've ever seen. I'm like, all right.
And you can kind of tell where people may have like, oh, well, I saw this in Metal Gear or whatever. James Bond had a lot of stuff with that, but you are kind of seeing like the feedback loop or the circle of influence in that sense. Something I wanted to start off with, which was kind of interesting, is that there's been a lot of sort of debate in codifying games as art when it comes to free speech and legal protection.
Boy. Yeah,
and I mean, this is another one that we could do a whole episode on.
Yeah,
but I think it's really important because it's sort of entered the conversation in that way where, you know, what the fuck do they know in Washington? But, you know, interesting that's the a way people look at it.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of maybe see if we each had a way of defining what is a game and what is art, and seeing if we can meet in the middle here.
Okay. I'm going to make a statement first. I'm so happy that we finally get this on mic because I can't believe the world is still debating whether video games are art. Yeah. I made the joke earlier in the episode that we've just been wrong cyclically about video games. No, video games aren't art for this and this reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think in terms of like your question, like what is a game, and like, what you asking me, what does that mean? Like, is the question.
If you could, define in very simple terms, what is immutable? What does a game need to have to be a game? What does art need to have to be art?
Sure. I think I can answer the first part. I think for me, for a game to be a game, I have to input something for the game to progress, for the thing to progress, which makes it a game. Mm-hmm. A movie will play whether I close my eyes, although the horror game will not end unless I finish it.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Good point.
In terms of what makes art, can I, dude, you're, oh my God, I'm going to laugh at you just for a second. Not in any sort of demeaning way. I had to answer that question so many fucking times as a part of my music degree. On my final essay. I don't know if I still believe this. I can't believe I actually get to make a connection to this. On my final essay before I got my music degree, they asked me, Greg, what is music? And so, can I tell you what I wrote? I said, if everything is music, then nothing is music. And why did I pay all this fucking money? So I answered it that way.
It's actually pretty.
But like,
bad.
what makes art art? Art is an expression of something, whether it is physical or oral, mm-hmm. Or it could be an idea. It could be something that's written. Mm-hmm. That's so hard. Does art even have a definition? In a
honestly,
dictionary?
I think it definitely does.
It has,
I mean, as we
I'm saying, like, but is the definition of art in a dictionary incredibly abstract? Like, does it tell you to see other word?
There's so many things that could be art, you know? I don't think it's really difficult to pin an entire definition to the word art or like say, like, and also, who the fuck are we to say what is art and what's not, right? Someone's art may not be my art.
I think it's important that we express our opinion because the other people are definitely expressing
theirs.
That's
very true.
That's true.
So I think we got to speak up on behalf of games.
So in that case, I tend to be pretty liberal on what I call art because I think pretty much any form of expression, like you said, Greg, is art. And any game that has some sort of expression like that is art. Maybe not Call of Duty.
All games fall. I think all video games fall under art mm-hmm. because it is either visual or oral or it requires input and someone had to make it.
And there's so much art that goes into a video game too, right? Even the most simplistic video game, like we just talked about Journey.
Yeah.
That has so much, it's bleeding style and art, whether it's through the visuals or through the soundtrack.
Dude, we just talked to Mike Bithell about Thomas Was Alone. It's rectangles jumping.
Yes, exactly.
And that's art.
Exactly.
But so, Riley, what do you have to say?
No, I agree what you said about games for sure. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe to further my definition of art would be expressing yourself in a way that is to you interesting or poetic or something, you know, like I think the source of all art and humor is comparison. So that always helps.
Okay.
Sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes it's more abstract. So I feel like, you know, I mean, this is why we have critics. Like, was it successful? Was it not? Etc. I feel like it is very much just because games are so young as a medium. Mm-hmm. A lot of the others have experienced this, including comics, films themselves. Every time sort of they came out, they kind of had their detractors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now as they go on, you know, I think there are certain people who are books only, you know, and that's fine. But I mean, there are certain people that you will never be able to convince.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking to you. You have your mind made up. You're not even listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What I'm talking to, I'm trying to, I guess, reassure you that I feel that this is a form of artistic expression and that it's worthwhile talking about. Otherwise, we wouldn't have done 75 episodes of a podcast.
Is goddamn GameCube art?
Yeah, 100%.
Yes,
100%.
Absolutely. But I did want to kind of tie in here with why I wanted to do this podcast and why I continue to do this podcast is because I feel like there is very little that is really looking at games in kind of a conceptual way. Like in terms of, there's good writers out there. I like Jason Schreier's reporting a lot. I feel like he's a very good voice for legitimizing the medium. Mm-hmm. But there is nobody out there who was really speaking the way I wanted to speak. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I feel like a lot of games, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we just talked about very minimal games, and so much of exploring minimal art is how much you personally bring to it and your lived experience and what kind of imagination you have. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, you know, like, oh, playing Journey. Oh, you just walk up a mountain, you know, and that's
right.
It. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, you're not like, I think that you really kind of need to be meeting it on its own terms, thinking about your own experiences and bring them to it. I wanted to mention some of the more popular critiques of video games.
Oh boy.
As here we go. Here. So I think in general, what characterizes these are that they are very limited by perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, I think over time we are seeing more and more people warm up to the idea, because what I have always felt is that there's the potential there. And even if it doesn't always live up to the potential of like having like a profound experience about, you know, like if there's, there are so many films that so subtly convey all the little different kind of tics and behaviors that humans have when they interact, or, you know, different aspects of life that are super subtle. And in terms of, like, you know, those are kind of considered like the pinnacle of whatever. And games are kind of in a difficult spot because number one, you don't have like, you know, Last of Us is probably like the closest you get where you can portray like a human in a such a super realistic way where mm-hmm. you can show all those little emotions and inflections of voice and everything. And you think about when some of these criticisms happened, it was, you know, 2005 earlier, and thinking about like, well, you know, it's just a bunch of crap. You know, what mm-hmm. came out like 2005, you know, like you know,
only one of the best game stories ever, Metal Gear Solid 2. But like, who's counting?
2001.
Excuse me.
So, yeah. But I wanted to bring up something interesting about that mm-hmm. because Roger Ebert is famously the original critic of this, where he said,
I'm scowling.
So I agree with him on a lot of stuff, except this and Big Fish. He didn't like Big Fish, which I thought was a great movie. But it basically boils down to considering games, you know, in terms of a pass fail scenario, which is something we talked about last episode. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to kind of explore that idea because he said, like, so what if Romeo and Juliet had a happy ending, like an alternate ending, like you mm-hmm. could unlock, like it would totally undo like the meaning of the story. And my counterpoint is like, if you were trying to make someone have that experience, that wouldn't be an option.
Right.
You could have kind of other choices, you know, that would define it. But if you wanted to make the story a tragedy, that it would that would be an immutable component. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make it any less of a game, in my opinion.
Yeah, of course. You're preaching to the choir here.
I know. I'm going through it. Yeah. You got some people talking about, you know, why are people so insistent on validating games as art? You know, you don't see people doing this with chess or sports. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, apples and oranges.
Yeah.
And this is something I brought up earlier, whereas chess does not have characters, doesn't have themes. It's all strategy. It's all, you know, skill. There is no, like, I'm talking about, I think a lot of these people, when they came up with these criticisms, were not thinking forward about what an open mind could do with this medium.
Yeah.
And the truth is that there's a lot. And what I wanted to say was this so shocking with me was that Kojima himself agreed with Ebert at the time. I'm not shitting you.
Wow.
And so I this was a surprise to me. So obviously he loves film, right? He loves film. Okay, get yourself together here.
Okay.
And so I get that where he, so basically he was, I don't know if he's changed his mind since then, but he was interviewed at the time. He says, no, I agree, you know, and the reasoning that he gave is that was, whereas art can kind of be whatever, games are, you know, the highest a game can be, the highest thing a game can aspire to is 100% player satisfaction. And that was his reasoning behind that. And I'd like to dig into that a little bit.
The highest thing that a game can achieve is 100% player satisfaction.
So meaning everyone who plays the game likes it or enjoys it.
For one reason or another.
So how is that any different than I saw a movie and it gave me 100% moviegoer satisfaction?
Or well, I guess because, I mean,
that's crazy. I can't even imagine that man saying that.
I know, right? But like, it's so funny because he is one of the biggest examples, I would say, of, you know, an auteur and kind mm-hmm. of like, I think what you really need is, because I guess so much of it depends on, even indie games maybe need to, you know, make their money back or whatever, and this is where the commercialization comes in and stuff. But I'm thinking, like, so if you make a movie, right, mm-hmm. and you know, you have indie films, blockbuster films and everything, I don't assume that anyone realistically believes they're going to please everyone, and if they do, you've got your head up
that
your
is
ass.
A strange standard,
you know,
to hold a game to.
Yeah, I don't.
Especially after he, in Metal Gear Solid 2, so deliberately wanted to disappoint people. I think, I will never fully understand the man, but I did want to bring up that it kind of muddies the waters of, you know, the argument that I was going to make is that he's like the biggest example of like, just do whatever you want and people can either get on the train or get off. You know what I mean?
It's such like a weird thing, right? Because I'm agreeing. I'm with. I mean, obviously, I'm not. You're just bringing up a point here, Riley. But Greg, like you say, no media has 100% satisfaction. right? Because like not everybody likes the popular song that came out. Not everybody, for some bizarre reason, not everybody likes Lord of the Rings.
I think only the most cynical voices of all media would be striving for 100% sass. Like, let's make something so watered down and bland that it appeals to literally everyone.
Do you know what my entire, you know what my sort of boiled down reaction to that is? They're holding games to a lower standard than everything else.
Sure.
We're like, oh, well, a movie doesn't do that. How do you, the fuck do you know that? Don't say that. Not right? You, not you, Riley, but you, these people.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man.
And I would like to also point out that because games are a much younger medium, there are far fewer of them than there are movies.
Sure.
And we tend to only remember the good movies.
Yeah.
Well, I need to just point that out, that there's a lot of like garbage films out there.
And we've watched a lot of them here, actually.
We have. It's a pastime of ours. But like every medium is going to have its successes and failures, people who, you know, make the most of it and people who don't.
Yep.
So I don't know. I think if you are listening to this podcast, you probably already have your mind made up.
Yeah.
Maybe not. I don't know. But I would like to reassure a little bit, because that's the way I feel. I think that's the way the three of us feel. Mm-hmm. A couple other points I had just before I get off the mount here.
Sure.
I would say that I think maybe the way people are thinking about that, where it's like you are just kind of satisfying that itch to play, to do something kind of that's not... It's not furthering any of your life goals, I guess, to just dick around or do something. I could see that more if you're thinking about lifestyle games or games where you're not like working towards anything. Mm-hmm. I think it's just kind of like, I don't know. I think there is an art to perfecting like gameplay too.
Yeah.
Because I feel like in terms of having something substantial, something that feels rewarding to go back to, I think that's a lot harder than people give it credit. Like the 30 seconds of fun or whatever, that's tough. That's tough to get right.
Yeah, I mean, and something that just popped into my head too, actually a couple of things, as I was just like angrily listening to these people's quotes about games.
Yeah.
Now you said perfecting gameplay. Did you mean from a developer's perspective or a player being good at it?
Either or.
Because you know what I just thought of? I practice playing music all the time. Is me practicing not art either? If I practice speedrunning Resident Evil, what's the difference? I don't know. I'm practicing producing all the time. I practice my playing and singing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not art either?
I guess it's kind of when it comes to like, who is that for? Because is art to be shared or is it just for you?
What I would argue is we actually talked about this in music history. I can't believe this is coming up. Where does music exist if no one hears it? I know it's interesting.
Now we're really getting into it.
Here we go.
But before we're not going to get, we could talk about this for hours. I tend to agree. My professor's argument is no, because music is meant to be heard. Mm-hmm. So if you're playing music only for you, half of music is other people hearing it with you in the room.
Interesting.
But you're hearing it.
Exactly. And so when it comes to like, that's why like, I kind of go back to my original boilerplate argument, where I just think for these people, you said perspective was a big part of the problem,
I guess.
For me, I think they're holding games to an incredibly low standard of what it is. Then also, like, who the fuck's curating what they're playing? Like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Put The Last of Us in front of, was that Roger Ebert? And tell me he hates it. Like, I don't know. I want to see that.
He's dead, so we can't do that.
Well, you know what? Let's go get Teresa Caputo in here. Let's revive him, I guess.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
I think a lot of it is you know, that art is to be experienced and not interacted with. And I don't agree with that either, because there are so many kind of like interactive exhibits, you know, museums and stuff like that, where it's, you know, it's all tactile. And I think not only that, you can kind of, I think if anything, interactivity is another layer where it's kind of, it's telling you things yourself and the choices you're making and asking like, wow, what kind of person am I? You know,
that's something that I'm glad you brought up. I think video games even bring our level of art higher because you can, I mean, come on, like we have movies, then people created video games. Now video games and movies are getting blurred together. And now Netflix has an interactive movie. There's Bandersnatch, right?
Yes.
Oh, so, okay. So it's a game. Now it's, and now they are like, I video games have now enhanced. I said it in my beginning argument. The horror movie will end if I close my eyes. The horror game will not end unless I choose to finish it. Right? I think that brings games to even, I'm not saying games are better than movies, but you get what I'm saying. It brings another aspect to what it is. I don't know how you couldn't argue that. Unless
I think there's also, I was thinking about a lot of, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages. And in terms of advantages, I was thinking about like Bloodborne, right?
Interesting.
And yep. How I haven't seen anything quite like it in a movie. You know what I mean? Like I've seen
Helsing.
Well, no, incredible film, but, you know, you have like Victorian horror and Lovecraftian horror being joined together. Yes. I've never seen that before.
Yeah,
think about how hard Bloodborne would have been to pull off as a movie. It would have been impossible.
Impossible.
Yeah. You have all these, and it's not just like, it's really not good for your benefit. It's really kind of to, I mean, it is partially for your benefit, but I'm talking about like all the little creatures and everything and how they interact with the world and all their behavior and everything. And it's all like, think about how to pull that off convincingly. You see a lot of CGI, it looks like crap.
Yeah.
And like everything in Bloodborne is, it's on the same kind of visual level. Nothing is sticking out of place. I'm never like broken from the immersion for that reason. And I think there's some like really incredible stuff that you can do with world building. And, you know, obviously like Bloodborne is how many, like 40 hours to play, you know, you can only spend 2-3 hours in a movie, you know, a series is kind of has its own pros and cons. It's like, it's really just, there are things that it does that no other medium does. And I think that alone is a great kind of, mark in its favor.
And I totally, you know, it also brings back to the point I made earlier where a video game and a book are very comparable.
Yeah.
And now we can also make the point, the movie adaptation of the video game sucked, where the movie adaptation of the book usually sucks.
Yeah. So, I think there's more in common with a book than a movie, for sure.
Because you have to put yourself in.
Exactly. Face it, you know, a lot more organically. Right. You know, I see a lot of shared DNA there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do we have anything else to add in terms of games and culture? I mean, this is the end of season 3. Is there anything else, Riley, that you want to say?
I guess to put a pin on it, where do you think games and culture will go and where do you hope they will go?
Unfortunately, I think games are going to, I hate, like NFTs and games as service and stuff I don't even want to talk about because I hate saying those words.
Manifesting it.
I just hate manifesting that stuff. VR, it's all going to happen.
Yeah.
Where would I, you know, it's so interesting. Interesting as in it's very mundane. I actually don't know where games are going to go, but I just like enjoying the ride. Now, I think I am going to have like one final quote for Greg for season 3. And then Nick, why don't you can say something as well, and then we'll sign off.
Sure.
I want to bring up one last funny thing about games and culture that only has, and not only me, but it seems to only happen to me. I have gotten, this is meant to be funny, I have gotten so many questions from either our friends in real life or people on the internet who say, Greg, do you even like games? Because we're so critical of games. Like some of our friends have said, do you even like the medium? And so to me in my brain, that is such a bizarre thing to ask me. Because what I want our fans and non-fans to know is that even when I hate playing a game I'm playing and I don't like it at all, I love the medium and I love experiencing it, even if I don't like it. And I tend to enjoy all media that way. I'm gonna finish all the movies I'm watching, even if I don't like them. I like it. The thing about games for me, if this is games and culture, games have meant a ton to me, not only as entertainment, but for something for me to really get into, not only how they work. We talk about them for hours a week in whether it's, you know, social, artistic, economic, technology, all of that stuff. I just love getting invested in the medium, even if I'm very critical of it. So, Nick, do you have anything to say in terms of games and culture before we put the final pin in season 3?
Damn, I'm supposed to follow that up. That was impactful. Okay, so I don't know where video games are gonna go as far as technical levels or anything like that. I mean, I can't even fathom what comes after VR. You know, what could possibly be more advanced than that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe I don't even want to think about it. But yeah.
The Matrix.
We become the Matrix. This is not great. But what I do hope from video games is, honestly, I just want them to continue to grow to be a more like acceptable,
tasteful,
topic.
You know, like making better choices across the board.
Yes. Thank you. Like a better, like you can more freely talk about video games like you would going to watch movies or like you would going to watch shows or reading books or whatever you want to do. Because I think sometimes like video games as an art form, sometimes you get such a profound, either it's a storytelling experience, artistic experience, more so than you'll find in some books, some music, some, you know, art galleries. Like we just did an episode about Journey. Mm-hmm. Like you can extract so many different sort of themes from that game.
And all the different components are working in tandem and they're all so remarkable.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. So. Like you're currently playing it. Greg, you and I both have played Disco Elysium, mm-hmm. which is a game that is one of the first games I've really played that focuses on the dialogue and the writing.
Very bookish. So. Very bookish game.
Right.
Now you're starting a ton of reading.
Yeah. And now you're starting to get video games that encapsulate so many different aspects of culture. And honestly, I love that, and I want to see where that goes from there.
I for my part, I would like to see games get smarter, even smarter. I feel like there's a lot of untapped potential with AI and kind of playing games with the player and kind of curating a specific experience, because I feel like that is, I mean, maybe not the most financially sound choice for a lot of these companies that are kind of getting more into the NFT game and the online, the always online DRM, all that stuff. But in terms of what I would like to see, definitely more of these single player experiences, maybe some cooperative experiences that make that a little bit more organic. You know, I'd like to see more of what I like and less of what I hate. I think that's what I got.
So that is going to do it for season 3. Thank you to everybody in the community. Thank you to Riley. Thank you to Nick, the intern, everybody who helps goddamn GameCube and the community and, everyone contributing to that effort. We will see you at some point around April. Please follow us on social. We are going to be very active, whether it's making YouTube stuff or it's talking with you guys on social. And like I said in the beginning, be on the lookout because we are going to be growing the community with various platforms. So this is Goddamn GameCube signing off for season 3. And just once again, I'm Greg. My co-host is Riley, and Nick the intern is a vital part of the team. And we'll see you guys in season 4. Thanks.